Hello, and thank you for joining us for the RealCom webinar. Today we'll be talking about data and analytics, and I'm very excited to have a great panel of speakers with me today. Before we get started, let's go over a few housekeeping items. You can use the Q&A section to ask your questions anytime during the webinar, and you can also download a copy of the presentation materials from the Headout section. For the best webinar experience, we recommend that you log out of any other applications that are currently running. And if you do run into any technical issues, you can contact me at sbenpratt@realcom.com. This session is also being recorded, and we'll send out a copy of the recording within the next few days. I'd like to thank the sponsors for today's session, Cherry, DealPath, Drone Deploy, and Navigator CRE, and our silver sponsor, Prescriptive Data. And with that, I'd like to introduce you to the moderator for today's event, Hazel Mann. Hazel is principal at Zeta Advisory, an organization that helps real estate investment management firms transform with practical tech solutions. She is an entrepreneur with over 15 years of experience in real estate operations and technology. Hazel, thank you very much for moderating. I'll turn it over to you.
Thanks so much, Sarah. Really happy to be here. Hi, everyone. We have a really great panel lined up for you today. Sarah, do we have the poll that we have lined up for everyone to take while I do the intro? Great.
Yeah,
so, perfect. So while I'm doing this intro of myself, go ahead and in the next minute, put where you are in your data journey, and then we'll take a look at this further on and compare it to pre-COVID. So I'm just going to introduce myself. My name's Hazel Mann. My background is asset management acquisition, starting on the CMBS side. I next worked for KBS Realty Advisors, the sixth largest owner of office globally. And I had founded Zeta Advisory because I found that searching for new technologies and piloting them was really difficult on top of my day job of reporting. So I combined my operating experience with my background in data science and product management to build more of a streamlined process for companies to understand what they need technology-wise and also to quickly find what is out there to meet those needs. So let's take a look at the poll now. Sarah, can you bring up? Okay, so yeah, we have, it looks like we have a lot of folks actively using analytics today, which is great. And then, wow, using advanced data regularly has combined with starting advanced analytics has usually only been 10%. But I'm happy to say this number is changing, and we have a lot of a greater shift toward folks who are using analytics. So thank you so much for that, Sarah. Let's go on to the slide deck, please. Great, so I'm going to give a brief intro on the state of data today. So compared to COVID, pre-COVID numbers, I take this poll every time I do a webinar or a survey. So you can see here that a lot of folks were just in the basics or the early stages. So we've seen this poll has been the poll where there's been more of a shift toward advanced analytics. And then this is really important because I kind of deal with top of the funnel technologies. My clients ask me to look at computer vision and blockchain and NFTs. And so seeing that people are moving toward being more friendly toward analytics, not just for the sake of data, but for the sake of getting the insights they need to make new kinds of decisions in today's market is really important. So even before COVID, Bain did a bunch of research that really the thing that you get out of analytics is you're faster than the competition. You can execute decisions more successfully. So before we started this whole thing, real estate data in the industry was recognized to be really broken because it's not always containing all the information you need. There might be things that are not relevant to your asset class or the data sets that you're looking for, if you're class A or class B. And a lot of times it's delayed because it's aggregated by quarter and there's a lot of smoothing out that happens. So you're usually 3 to 5 months behind the data you need to make decisions. So there's a really big opportunity to automate a lot of the manual processes processes that the industry has been doing for years, and to make the technology really practical for the users instead of something that's like only an IT project and super hard to use for anyone who's not a database administrator. And the last thing is getting data that's real time so you can make decisions faster is also really important. So I looked at all of the surveys and data, because this wouldn't be a data panel without some data. And on the landlord side, it's just they don't really know what they want to do, because the data that they're getting isn't trustworthy. The only 6% trust it, because they think there's a very long delay that is not conducive to making more updated decisions about their buildings and their tenants. And 85% don't feel confident that they can use the data that they have to predict what tenants really need today. And we see a large number of them wanting to adopt new tech. And this is from a combination of large industry surveys by both BTS and MRI. And next, on the tenant side, looking at what that data was saying, there's a huge shift on how they fundamentally look at their real estate. And over 72% had a quarter or less employees on site during the crisis. And so most of them are negotiating new lease terms or breaking leases, and over half are needing less space than before. And this is really reflected in the mergers and investments going today. Resi data, because there's been this huge push in investment in residential, that's gearing up. We have our own Sierra Navigator on the panel today, getting funded this year to bring that kind of intelligence together. A lot has to do around construction and more transparency and cost savings on for bottom line. And on top line, we see a lot of building experience investments for Latch and HQO. So that's more of tenant retention and revenue. And the thing that's not on this that I get pinged about pretty much almost every other day is work order systems. So more transparency about how the buildings are being operated. So with all of this in mind, this is the setting of what we're looking at today to discuss with our panelists, who we have a really great mix of backgrounds and perspectives. So I'd like to introduce our next panelist, Aaron Elzer. He works for CAR. He is the director of IT technology initiatives at CAR Properties, and he leads their IT innovation efforts and is an architect and developer of CAR data analytics, IoT, machine learning, AI, and hospitality platforms. And so for 2022, his projects have included IT innovation around data automation and the return to work movement. So I'll have Aaron take it from here.
Thank you, Hazel. It's great to have everyone here today. And I'm looking at this as really an exciting time in the data movement. It's great to see the results of the poll that more people are investing in and paying attention and implementing big data, because I think that helps the industry. It helps the industry kind of negotiate this tough time that it's in. So just to reiterate my focus over the next 12 to 18 months is really on figuring out what to do with the data that we've been collecting and visualizing to get the biggest bang for the buck, really in terms of like the return to work movement and creating automation around a lot of the data that we've collected. And I'll go through today some of the projects that we have in motion that talk about those two topics. So just quickly, a little bit about CAR Properties. We are based in Washington, D.C., and we're a privately held real estate owner, operator, developer. Our portfolio spans between D.C., Boston, and Austin, Texas, so the D.C. metro area, including Northern Virginia and Maryland. We're 4.4 million square feet, about 2.5 million square feet in active development and just in the delivery process now through D.C., Maryland, and our largest project in the One Congress in Boston, which is 1 million square feet alone. It's gonna be a beautiful project. So keep your eyes open for that one. So CAR has been on this data journey for a couple of years. And we oftentimes get asked about the data strategy. I mean, it's oftentimes a, let me get to the next slide here. There we go. We oftentimes get asked about our data strategy in forums like this and just around our business and industry. And at the simplest level, we tried to address the data strategy, really outlining four problems. And these are four problems that we faced internally, but problems that we hear from many others in the industry. So first and foremost, the reason to have a data program is because we have so many disparate systems. Each of those systems has separate logins, which means transparency issues, access issues. And the analytics program allows us to create a single source, which is a single pane of glass where people can log in and see what's going on with many different data sets. So the second problem that we were looking to address is that the data itself is fragmented, that we have data coming in from different systems, but the data doesn't really talk to each other. We can't make sense of it across multiple systems. So we knew that was the second problem that we wanted to tackle here. Third is really the data is just data. It's it's information, and it oftentimes doesn't provide you the direction to act on it. So we looked at the data currently is not actionable. We really wanted to create some action around the data itself to have it start working for us as an asset to our business. And then lastly, with all the improvements in machine learning and the AI initiatives, we knew that we could get some proactivity around our data to have it become, you know, really an asset, a brain, a tool that we can use to help us make decisions and look into the future. So starting this journey, we knew that we had a lot of systems in our buildings that collected data, and there's so many, it can be overwhelming. So we looked at all the different categories that provided data, and we're talking about really older systems that, you know, don't have clean REST APIs that you can just call, but we knew that there was great information from them. So we looked at one particular building in downtown DC where our HQ is, and we looked at it as a kind of a living, breathing piece of our world. And we said, okay, well, this system is going to be the brain, and what are all the data sources that feed into this brain? And this is going to develop sort of like a nervous system to the building of all these different categories and types. So we surveyed everything from our utility information, our facility management information, our engineering data, other type of internal activities. Like we have a strong hospitality program with amenity offerings. We looked deep into our fitness centers to see, you know, traffic, our network connectivity in the centers, and also even our fitness equipment, and we could pull data off of those devices. And even externally, we're surveying news for our customer base, social media for our customer base, and aggregating that information as well. So once we got all the data organized, we knew that we couldn't just serve it up in a way that the business didn't understand. So at CAR, we focus our information around four pillars of, they're basically four categories. We call them the four business pillars. And this was definitely a lesson learned, because data programs can be extremely overwhelming. And for our business, we wanted to frame the information that we were providing out to the business to align in the business pillars that our business already understood. So for us, we look at data in terms of wellness, hospitality, space optimization, and sustainability. So as we look to expand other data sets into either new IoT devices, new programs, new systems, we look to make sure that the data falls within one of those areas of interest for our business. So then when we serve up a visualization or a tool, we can reference back to the business pillar that it reflects to, and then we'll get greater buy-in and greater understanding for it. So just a quick system layout and system design of the lay of information here. So our system flow, it really starts with the data itself. So here on the left-hand side, we start with our source data. We're aggregating through flat file, API, scheduled report, really take any and all kinds. And we funnel this information into an aggregated like supercomputer. We call it our Plasma server, but it's the server that runs the crons to fetch data. It hosts our database. And allows us to build applications on top of the system. So one note, our Plasma server, we do use a managed service for this. We use RestorePoint. They manage the service just because we have several dozen different like REST feeds that are connected to it. Some custom scripting that is used to parse data, map data, et cetera. So once we have our kind of core engine here, we look at leveraging this through three different applications. So the green boxes here is really our application layer. We have our visualization, we have our AI engine, and then we have our automation hub. So one of the really the big lesson learned here from two and a half years of doing this is just the value that we've gotten from decoupling the server and database from the visualizer. I see a lot of people that are getting into these data initiatives that they invest heavily in a Sisense or a BI, a Power BI, and the data lives solely within the system. And then what I've seen is that people become dependent on these front ends. And then as the new best of breed tool comes out, they are kind of hamstrung with what they're currently using. So we have decoupled and only use the visualizer to send snapshots of our data up to. So we can change, and I think we're on our third visualizer at the moment. So I'll talk just quickly about AI and automation, and then I'll show you some examples. So we are partnered with a company called Okapi, and we send our data up to Okapi. Okapi runs some AI in several different formats. They compare those results to our service level that we provide to our customers. And then what the Okapi information tells us is the sentiment of our customers, and also gives us predictive intelligence of how happy our customers are and how satisfied they are with our products. So down here with automation, this is really the hot topic of the day. We have developed really an internal software that layers on top of our data that allows us to author our own rules and triggers to create action from our data. And I'll show you some examples of how we're using that today. So just on the visualizer, I know everyone always asks, you know, what are you using? What tools are you using today? So we have used Sisense, we've used Power BI, we're using this tool now called ThoughtSpot. We won't get into endorsements or not, but using ThoughtSpot as of today. This is just a quick snapshot of Okapi. Again, this is the tool that, again, sits on top of the Plasma server that ingests our data and provides predictive analytics, predictive intelligence, and gives us a sentiment like customer satisfaction analysis. Okay, so let's talk about monitoring, and we'll use the example of IAQ and IEQ data. So I know that's a hot topic for return to work. CAR is in the midst of piloting an IAQ program where we have IAQ sensors, we have integrated into our BMS nodes, and we are doing edge filtering with the Aura Air. So through this program, we piloted probably four or five different brands of IAQ devices. So what we did is we set basically a common data model that takes all the sensor data, it normalizes it, and it sends it into our Plasma server program. And then this allows us to write these set limits. So what happens if a reader, a node, reads a limit that's over a threshold that's been set, then we trigger an alert policy that's set by our automation software. So we have the control to define the alert policies, to configure the alert policies, to change them. But what happens is then we get to create action from the alert policy that's generated. So in this example, we're going to trigger an alert policy that that writes a post API, and this post API pushes a ticket up to our work order system Prism. So this would be like sort of a base level one integration from IAQ data out to the work order system. So as we look into the future of what we can do with this data, because we have cast this really wide net of data collection, we now get to look at it in understanding of relationships to one another. So in this example, I'm highlighting data from an air quality sensor, access control, so a door reader, and then also operations data from our ticketing system. So because we've been collecting all this data, now we have a rule writer or rule author tool with automation, then you can start to write write actions that have relationships on one another. So in this case, let's say we have a trigger that's set up to trigger when you have over 100 event IDs at a card reader in an hour. And let's say we wanna layer that with IAQ data, CO2, we're gonna get over a 1200 PPM read. So if these two things happen, then we send an improvement command to the BMS or the engineering team to implement the BMS command. So on the flip side, we could be looking at access control, access control in our conference space. And then we could also look at historic data on this space and say, okay, well, this space typically gets greater than five tickets a month for hot cold calls. So if these two events trigger, then we want to flag something to our property management or our senior property management reporting deck that's reviewed once a month. The example down below, where we look at ops data and IQ data, we could send alerts out to engineers. And then lastly, let's say we hit all three of these thresholds, then we're queuing a work order back to Prism or back to our ticketing system. And I'm really looking at this whole relational model as being the secret sauce, because that gives us now the control, the visibility into our data, and then our ability to tune the program as we go forward. So I'm really excited about what's to come in big data and analytics, and really jazzed about just the power of automation behind it. So thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Aaron, for the presentation and really great resources and thoughtful process on the building side and the building perspective. So for folks that like who were in my shoes back then of looking at a portfolio of properties that are both a mix of analog and ones with BMS, for folks who have, it looks like most people have analytics. So if you have just or if you want to have analytics on your building and get more of where you are today, how do you get started with kind of evening out that view across buildings that might not always give you the same type of analytics?
So first and foremost is the power of decoupling the data and setting up a repository to start collecting. You might have to get creative and look at ways of pulling flat files and ways of integrating flat file data with APIs, but the decouplement is a key first. Secondarily, we found that using what we call a common data model, which takes data from different resources that are like kind and making them all speak the same language. That has been really valuable. And lastly, I do want to touch on one thing in terms of just expectations, specifically around the IQ IoT program. And we've been probably 6 months into this IoT program with IQ sensors. And I think it's foolish for people to think that you're going to implement IQ and then immediately see benefits the next day, because as we saw, nobody's in the buildings, the products are all new. But one of the greatest values that we are already seeing is it allowed us to give an understanding of what's currently going on in our buildings. So everybody thinks that you know what's going on in terms of air quality because you have your Siemens BMS, but this allowed us to basically give a spot check and to validate whether that was true. And in our case, many times it was not true. We had BMS nodes that needed to be recalibrated. We had temperature sensing nodes that were not in the correct position, fan speeds that were not running correctly. So once we started this whole IoT program, even before the IAQ piece provided us any understanding of VOCs or CO2, we were able to make our BMS better. So a little bit off topic of where you were going, but that was such a good lesson learned for us in the last 45 days that I wanted to share.
Yeah, that's definitely on topic, because setting expectations on IoT projects, right? You're like, oh, it's a sensor, it should work, we have a system. And they don't realize there's 100 ways for either the software side or the hardware side to go wrong. So that's a really valid add to the conversation. So thank you so much for sharing, Aaron, and really great perspective on the building, operations, and really happy to hear what you guys are building and excited to see what you'll do next. So thank you so much, Aaron. And we're going to switch to our next speaker right now, Pete Shu Chow. He has over 15 years experience in real estate technology and data management. He's at Invesco right now. I knew him back in his old days at Saxony Partners, one of my top data buddies in the industry to talk about data models and how to use data. He has a lot of enterprise projects on both the commercial and residential side of real estate, and he's worked directly with some of the largest organizations in both sectors and spent several years providing consulting services for many other well-recognized names. So Pete, I'll have you take it from here.
Awesome, thanks Hazel. Get this on here, guys. All right, so again, as Hazel mentioned, appreciate everybody joining today, taking the time to listen and share questions, insights within our industry. So what I want to kind of talk through here is a little more of an operational approach. Some of the things that we've worked with through our asset management groups, our partners, and our portfolio managers as well, and kind of how we're navigating the paradigm shift really as we've come out of kind of the pandemic, going through it, and what that's kind of shown us, and some of the operational changes that will stay with us for the long term and are for the better. So we'll dig into that a little bit. And Hazel, if you want to pop to the next slide here. So just to be, kind of concise here, what I really wanted to focus on was, what has the last 18 months really taught us? And so a couple of different topics here, and I'll go into a little more detail. And I also want to talk about this image on the right too, because I specifically placed this in here for a reason. But really, what has shifted from an operational perspective? First we looked at, how allocated are we to at-risk sectors? And so your two really biggest at-risk sectors, number one was retail, right? Because with a lot of lockdowns, shops closing for certain periods of time, your brick and mortar retails, restaurant bars, were kind of the biggest initial focus on who was going to be impacted the most with these changes in these mandates. And so there was a step back to look at, okay, how allocated are we to retail? And then really kind of an increased look at, okay, well, where are we allocated in terms of not just sector, but location based on some of the emergency mandates and kind of who's coming out of these, sooner, who's coming out of them later, where our assets are in relative to that, and would we start expecting to see an uptick in retail again and rents of that nature. So it accelerated that trend a little bit. E-commerce had already, kind of started taking a chunk years ago of brick and mortar stores. And this kind of accelerated that as well. And then, same with office. We have a large office portfolio. There were some, concerns. Office was looking a little more risky long-term from a market perspective in some areas. And so the question kind of became, as, the social distancing mandates came into play for our tenants in our office buildings, do we think that they're going to, one, obviously close shop, two, will they implement something like a hybrid work model where they can keep their current square footage that's allocated, or and do a hybrid work from home so they have less employees in the office so they can expand the space a little bit more? Or do we believe that they may just expand and take on additional square footage to accommodate their employees and keep social distancing mandates in place? So it shifted a lot to the wholesale strategies that we had in place. But again, you had a focus on some of these trends already, and then it was a massive uptick on, okay, we really need to focus on these two areas. And so that was from a portfolio perspective, that was one of the biggest areas and impacts that we looked at. From the operational perspective and from the asset management perspective, probably the biggest blind spot that we realized we had was, do we really know who our tenants are? And, you know, and I say that question, and I've said it in meetings before, and, you know, asset managers, partners, of course we know where our tenants are. We know where our tenants are. We have leases there. Okay. But do we really know what industry classification they're in? Do we really know who their parent companies are? You know, how does that, you know, impact our insights as to who's at risk and who's not? And going kind of to the graphic here on the right, this is an asset that we own in Austin called Music Lane, high-end retail shopping center right off of Congress. If you're ever in Austin, great place to stop, shop, get lunch, great places in there. But on that bottom floor there, there's a company called Reformation. And if you've never heard of Reformation, they are essentially, on the outset, it's a small boutique clothing retailer, focused high on sustainability, environmental impacts. They've got a great business model, great plan. If I look at them on the surface, I'm thinking, man, this is a boutique retail sector. This should be a highly risky client at this point, tenant, because of, you know, what I just know by looking at them, what I know from their lease. But if you peel the onion back a little bit, they're actually owned by a group out of London called Permira. Permira has 44 billion euros in capital committed to multiple sectors right now. They do heavy investments in retail. They actually own Doc Martens, which is one of the most recognizable retail brands in the world. They have significant investments in technology sector, significant investments in the healthcare sector. And so their parent company has plenty of capital on hand. So it changes that perspective to say, you know what, I thought this was just a boutique retailer. Turns out they're very capital infused. They have great backing from a PE firm. And so that kind of changes my perspective on, do I view them as a high-risk profile or tenant or not? And so we started seeing some of those lineages, and the focus from asset management became more on, okay, let's start mapping these lineages out. Let's figure out who these parent companies are and really get a true assessment and qualification of where we feel the at-risk tenants are. You know, same thing with Amazon and, you know, Zappos, Amazon, Whole Foods, Amazon box stores, Amazon industrial. So we started making the lineages there. And then another one, the Louis Vuitton Mill White Holdings company. I'm not sure if everybody knows, but Louis Vuitton has a significant portfolio of companies that they own. And so, you know, we have, you know, Louis Vuitton, Burberry, and many of our high-end retail outlets. So again, while it might on the surface look like some of these individual retail shops may be at risk, when you look at their parent company, it dials back that risk profile quite a bit, and you realize they are very well capital infused. So again, that added into some details around the tenant trends, rent collection capabilities, things of that nature, and what we focused on any type of concessions that we would make. So thirdly here on the list, it really shone the light on which partners are really providing us with the best and most accurate empirical data in terms of, again, tenants, lease profiles, NAICS codes, industry, things of that nature. And so we started looking at all the data that was flowing into our Yardi database on a monthly basis. We push Yardi down to our partners. We are owners, not operators. And so our operators enter the data directly into our Yardi platform. So we started doing a program where at the end of each month, we would pull our database and we would see the number of exceptions. So we put some stringent business rules in place as to what fields are required when a new tenant or new lease goes into place, what's required at the time of an acquisition of a property, and as we set up all those leases and everything in Yardi. And we started looking to say, how many exceptions are we seeing month on an average? Where are we seeing the most exceptions? And starting to look and saying, okay, are we seeing particular operators that are, you know, on a recurring basis giving us the highest number of exceptions? And that started shifting and changing the game a little bit to focus on more empirical data-driven insights as to who are our best performing partners in terms of data management and in terms of getting us what we need to analyze, get that over to our strategic team, get that over to our investment teams and say, hey, these sectors are performing the best. These partners are performing the best in those sectors. And let's really start looking as we bring on new acquisitions, or as we come up on some of these contracts with our partners, and see who we really want in those seats to start operating those assets. So that was a game changer for us. And we're still building on that. We have a good analysis now of about 3 months trends. And you're really starting to see who operates best in what sectors, who operates best in what regions, and who operates what sectors best in what regions. And it's really powerful. So it's dialing back a little bit of the, hey, I really like these guys because I like, you know, their approach, they're friendly, you know, they work well with tenants, and adding a layer of, okay, fantastic. So we have the pathos, you know, equation solved. Now let's put some logical data behind it and let's really see and drive those insights from there. So that also started bringing to light, you know, who's bringing us, again, the best deals, who closes the deals the fastest. We rely heavily on VTS for that information in our lease pipeline. We added some additional required fields for brokers to input that information specifically around industry. That way we could see really who's looking, compare that with who's in our portfolio and who's able to, you know, pay their rents right now during the pandemic. And again, as I touched on before, you know, who's has the less or who's giving the least amount of exceptions on monthly and quarterly data submissions. So all this data cleanup, lineage, higher focus on data accuracy, higher focus on data consistency has really helped streamline and is continuing this trend of client RFP and investor RFP DDQ responses. We're getting to where we can do that faster. We can do that more accurate. We can do that with more confidence. And this wasn't necessarily something we knew this was a challenge, but we didn't exactly when we set out on shifting some of these operational procedures to adapt to the pandemic. This is one of the downstream benefits of that, because now when I work with our head of our client portfolio management group, Colin Oberg, I can provide him empirical information and say, hey, Colin, for this DDQ and these responses, here's our portfolio. Here's where our assets are. Here's our tenants. We had a big conference in Australia where we had a potential investor challenge us on, hey, we know office isn't performing right now and you guys are heavily allocated to office. We were able to turn that around overnight and basically say, look, we have X number of opportunities with people looking to take down leases of, you know, 25,000 square feet, 50,000 square feet, 100,000 square feet in office space. Here's our weighted average lease term on our office buildings today. And it showed them that the pipeline for us is still heavy on office. Our tenants are paying their rents on time. And there are still some very long-term leases with some very attractive tenants in these opportunities. And it helped us bring that investor to closure and get them more confidence in what we bring to the table and our portfolio structure. So that's been a huge win. And again, just being able to respond to these faster, these DDQs and RFPs, and more accurately, that's also looking at a competitive advantage, because now when our CPMs get these requests in, they can turn these around, and it just builds that confidence level for them to say, you know, hey, I reached out to Invesco, and they were able to turn this information around in 2, 3, 4 days, where it was taking, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and times before. So that's been a huge win for our organization. And then lastly, really what the last 18 months has taught us in summary, it's highlighted the value of your data assets. Everybody on this call, everybody dialed in, all the presenters, we all know this. We all know the value of your data assets. And it's been a challenge in the industry to kind of get everybody else on board with this. But this whole selling of data governance now, it's a thing of the past. I have our management committee folks come to me now and say, hey man, you know what would be really great if we could do XYZ? Now that we have this data, I'm starting to see these trends. It'd be great if we could layer these things on. And so I'm not having to go and ask for resources or help some of the funding. It's basically being allocated and it's just organically growing. So it's been a great model to adapt to the speed of the business.
Great. So thank you, Pete. Thank you so much for your perspective on all the advanced analytics you guys are doing. I think one thing that you have to lend to the conversation that's very powerful is the assumption that, okay, we can just get going with all the advanced analytics that you're doing before, right? But it's kind of like an iceberg. There's a lot underneath that people don't see on how you got to where you are today. And you started with Invesco a little bit before the pandemic. So putting structures into place was really important. So for you, why would you say it's even more critical today to have real estate firms start with people and processes before layering on technology and kind of rushing ahead and searching for tech solutions?
Right. I mean, all your big shops, you know, all of us, you know, we all have the same platforms, right? Almost everybody has the core. You have a Yardi, MRI, or JDE. You have a deal pipeline tool. You know, you have, you know, usually some flavor of, you know, some analytics. But it's if we're having to go through now and see all these challenges that we have in our data and the challenges we have in reporting, and when you're getting asked these questions and you're like, hey, I wish I could answer, but we really don't have the data, it's helped sell that message that the technology is there and there's no technology that's going to magically come loaded, preloaded with data. And so that light bulb has gone off to say, well, I get it now. When you come to meetings and say, we need to, you know, maximize on our current technology investments before we keep looking, that light bulb has gone off. And it's also, you know, as we get requests in from providers, hey, we have a new portfolio reporting solution, or, you know, we have a new tool we'd like you to look at. There's a more collaborative effort to say, well, what data sets do you need to really, you know, empower that tool? So that's, it's kind of the time to capitalize on that. The understanding is there that we have the technology in place, but now there's a clear understanding that without the people in the process behind that, you're spending money on a licensing fee that you're not getting the full benefit out of.
Awesome. Well, really, really great to have you again, Pete. Always nice to see the world from your perspective and how you really dig into the data and are able to really use it and leverage it for some really unique decision making. So thank you for your time. Great to have you today.
Absolutely.
Thanks. Great. I'm going to switch over to Kevin Schaffman. Kevin is the COO of Navigator CRE. He oversees their global enterprise engagements, and he has over 16 years of experience and is recognized as one of the leading commercial real estate tech executives in the industry. Knew him back in his Deloitte days, and we were super, really super great to meet him and have his perspective in this industry. So always happy to have him on a panel or just to talk to, because he's a noted speaker, author, and blogger within the growing prop tech sector. So thank you so much for being here today, Kevin, and I'll have you take it away from here.
Thanks, Hazel. Appreciate the intro. For any of those unfamiliar with Navigator, what we do, think about the requirement of accelerating, ingesting data, auditing data, remediating what you uncover in problematic data, then integrating all of it together, then visualizing it. That's what we do. That we have a ton of clients that have advised us across property types, across real estate life cycle stages, and across geographic locations. And we have the fortune, right, of working with a bunch of big companies, and they've provided us with feedback, both solicited and unsolicited, about what's important to them when they think about returning to work. And I think it's important for us to think about the metrics that were high priority, right? When before COVID struck, I'm gonna go down to the next slide here. At first, it was about finding the right deals, right? Growth at all costs, acquisitions were super important. And we can talk about that later with our integration with DealPath, how it's kind of a nice symbiotic relationship, helping clients find the right deals and then accelerating their workflows. But that all changed very, very quickly when COVID came on. It wasn't about acquisition disposition. It became about aged receivables, delinquencies, COVID-19 abatements, blend and extend leases. And what that then drove was what Pete brought up, which was how much do we know about our tenants, right? He gave an example of LVMH and their, you know, lease agreements that fall under their parent entity. You need to think about that for a second. How many different brands fall under the LVMH brand? It's not just Louis Vuitton and Moët Chandon and Hennessy. It's Bulgari. It's Givenchy. It's Marc Jacobs. It's Rimowa. There's cosmetics. There's jewelry. There's clothing. There's a bunch of different brands, all with their own lease agreements. And how that consolidates up to parent entity helps you understand the strength of those lease agreements, the renegotiation of those across your entire portfolio. It matters a lot. If you're an asset manager thinking about how you deal with all that information, a lot of people think that the most important metric for the now normal is actually how we return to work. It's not, right? It's absolutely not. It is operational productivity, because operational productivity drives everything else. It drives financial performance, which then creates the profit that pays for all the nice to have initiatives in a company, but it also drives worker retention and happiness. If you are doing things in a productive fashion and you feel like your role is providing value to the company, you're more likely to stay with the company. And so everything should be measured in this vein of operational productivity, especially if people decide they're only going to come into the office a couple days a week. They need to collaborate then from home or from Starbucks or from other places. So when people are making decisions and they're not all in the same building and they need to collaborate from multiple venues over some sort of virtual platform like Zoom or GoToMeeting, et cetera, what's more important to them isn't the underlying data that's used to make decisions, it's the decisions themselves. So Pete mentioned working backwards, and that's exactly the point we try to drive on. Start with what insights are required, and then work backwards to understand what data would actually drive those decisions. And these decisions are going to be very different if you are an occupier of a building whose business is actually not real estate, but you care a lot about the buildings you are in and what comes next and where you're going to grow or change or create a hybrid environment, what your services you're going to use inside the building, what feedback you're going to provide to the landlords and owners. There's a bunch of questions here that I'm not going to read off, but how your data is gathered, audited, remediated, ingested, integrated, and visualized should be used for basically the sole purpose of answering all of these questions, both in a reactive nature and in a proactive nature. Those questions are very different if you actually own the asset yourself and operate it every day, and even more different if you're like Invesco and you don't operate the assets on the ground, but you're relying on JV partners and property managers to deliver all these results to you. In order to have that information quickly, you need to think about data holistically, how you actually get it in the same place, how you audit it to understand what data is missing, what's duplicated, et cetera, and then how you fix that information so that once you visualize it, the business actually trusts it. Because the worst thing that can happen to you is a dashboard is built and the business says, well, I don't know if I trust the validity of this data. And that's going to be very different in different corporate departments. People involved in acquisitions will have a different view of information than people in accounting or people in legal or people in HR or people in Europe versus people in North America. The same platform, right, should address questions from all of these different groups, and they should all be able to collaborate from a single pane of glass, like Aaron mentioned at Carr, right? You should be able to, in a single click of a button, go to different parts of the business, and you shouldn't need a bunch of technical knowledge or expertise to address it. The answers should just be there on the screen. And that's why getting feedback from your end line users on how they evaluate data is so important. I spoke quickly, I said a lot. Happy to answer whatever questions may come from the audience or from you, Hazel.
Of course. Really great presentation, Kevin. I think there's a lot of great takeaways from those questions that a lot of the audience can look into and start answering. So thank you for providing those. So what would be your advice for owners or operators and occupiers who, you know, we see most of them are actively using analytics today, right? So I'm assuming, okay, you're maybe seeing stuff from your Yardie or MRI or Building Engines or Argus, analytics from a lot of different places that don't hold the picture that you just showed us on the last slide. So say you have analytics, but they're all in different places, right? Where would you take it there for next steps?
Well, I think you need to rely on the business to prioritize what's actually important to them. So there's this great slide that Aaron had up from Carr where they created this nerve center and it was feeding information across the business for a bunch of feeds. That's a great end state. But what we've learned with most of our clients, and these are some pretty big names, right? It's Blackstone, it's Starboard Capital, it's Brandywine, it's Newmark. These aren't small shops. And even at that level, they've given us feedback that, yeah, social media data is nice to have. We're not making a bunch of decisions from it. Right, it's like net promoter scores are great if we want to reach out directly to tenants that provide that feedback when we're doing lease renegotiation. But other than that, that's not highly valuable. What's valuable to us is what's going to drive operational productivity. So it's building access information, and it's not actually robotic process automation for fixing temperature in a suite. It's actually then switching the paradigm and saying, we're going to give more self-service control to the people inside the building. So if they're worried about temperature and sweep, they actually get the right to change the temperature. So instead of submitting a work order and requiring maintenance and then wanting to make a comment on how long it's taking, they can go directly change it themselves, right? And that also makes you think about what hardware systems you have in the building and the software platform that integrates with them so that you can basically give more control and power back to the tenants. I think that becomes super, super important. And then on the internal side, like Pete mentioned, it's how do we quickly evaluate who are our best JV partners, who are our best property managers, and is there a standard scoring framework so that we're not letting our biases get in the way? Are there benchmarks of performance? Are there benchmarks to speed? Are there benchmarks to communication and responsiveness? It's all about standardizing that across all of your systems, because not all systems are going to track things in the same way. So you should be visualizing not only as dashboard format the results, but you should be visualizing how you came to those results. What is the standard definition of economic occupancy across your entire organization?
Great, great. So yeah, I think that is so super helpful, because you can drown in analytics and data all day and not have anything useful. So definitely backing into what is the prioritized decision and then figuring out what data you need to get there in all those cases you mentioned is super helpful. So always great to have you on, Kevin. Thank you for sharing. And we're going to move on to our next presenter. We have Gary Cao. He serves as VP of Business Development at DealPath. And previously, he was a product manager of enterprise at Conjoya, which was acquired by Ultimate Software. And he was practice lead at Hewlett-Packard Enterprise. Gary, great to have you on today.
Thanks, Hazel. And hi, everyone. It's great to speak here today. So as Hazel mentioned, as a brief background, I work and cover business development and operations at DealPath, work on a number of strategic initiatives here, which includes working with a number of clients on their data strategy and optimization as they build out the roadmap for that work. So just as a quick background, you know, we work with real estate investment management firms around deploying deal management solutions. And for today, we'd love to go through three common trends we've seen throughout the past few years around this kind of journey, as well as take you through two brief case studies that our clients have kind of gone through with us to show how they kind of completed that as well. So with any initiative, it's important to understand and map out what the long-term outcomes are. Similarly, it's also important to ensure that you are gaining value creatively throughout the process. So, you know, what we've often seen as the first step of a journey is oftentimes simply beginning the process of digitizing your process so that your team can continue to work and focus on their priorities. From that point, you can actually take a more iterative approach around what to improve on and new functionalities to adopt from. So some commonalities we've seen across the workflow optimizations include things like user and access management, data completeness, requirements and governance around that, approval workflows, standardizing dashboards, reports to simplify visibility. And ultimately, we want to help ensure that the competitive insights and data is flowing in once you have things stood up. The other thing we're seeing with this is as you're deploying and utilizing these solutions, oftentimes by leveraging SaaS platforms, you're getting the best in class solutions, which allows you to get updates continuously that are really vetted by industry feedback. So you're able to take advantage of a lot of that stuff. So really allowing your platform to evolve organically into the best version of itself by leveraging that solution there. We also see the ability to capitalize on integrations as a pretty important part of any technology nowadays. So as both Aaron and Pete has mentioned before, being able to leverage best-in-class solutions, decoupling kind of this generic solution approach towards solving for your team's needs has been something that's been growing. And as part of that too, you can leverage and lean on quite a bit of the work that these technology platforms and providers are being done in the background. So as Kevin mentioned before, and that will be coming up soon, a lot of us on technology side do talk to each other, and we have been working pretty hard to make sure that integrations and communications are happening so that it becomes pretty seamless to slot in and out and kind of integrate with best-in-class peers. So you know, consider using a platform that can integrate and leverage your existing tech stack to maximize your adoption and efficiency as well. As part of that too, it's also important to understand what is standard and what is non-standard. So as you're thinking through customizations and one-off builds, oftentimes there might be solutions that might solve for the initial reason that you are doing a one-off implementation that could come from buying a generic software. So important to understand and go back to what is the ultimate problem solving for the users and thinking from there to build out what you are going there as well. And then similarly, it's important to learn what can be achieved versus what has already been built. So understanding where the platform is going, making sure that these are aligned with your best in class and kind of use cases there as well. Finally, I think around implementation, ensuring that your implementation does have outcomes every step along the way to get the max out of it and drive adoption as well. Oftentimes you are most likely not the first deployment. So there are abilities to leverage on what's been successful and what's been seen in an industry. While all commercial real estate investment orgs are different to an extent, there are some similarities as well. So the good news is that you're not starting at point zero in a lot of these journeys. There's best in class learnings. There's resources you can use outside to really understand how to really go about these change and allow you to kind of focus on the investment part of it as well. And over time, as we've seen, being able to avoid generic CAM tools that forces your process to adapt instead of streamlining your existing process, that's something that we've seen happen periodically as well. So there's quite a bit of work you can do to automate the templatization and standardization of the work too as you build out your different data sources. Going through one example that we've kind of worked through, Oxford has been a great client of ours and we've been partnering with them for a number of years now. Initially, they really approached trying to solve for a challenge of centralizing and improving access to real-time and historic data, and they want increased efficiencies and process improvements in deal management workflows. So a big part, the first step for them really was recognizing that they do not want to do software development in-house, as it's not Oxford's core competency, and they would like to implement something for this. So it's been a great partnership with them where we allowed, the ability to reduce quite a bit of work there and automate quite a bit of things, allowing them to centralize and standardize their data workflow and kind of really allocate their time towards investment as well. And so with that, I'll hand it back to Hazel, who I believe will be playing the next part of this case study as well.
Yeah, thank you, Gary. So we're going to proceed to the video for the case study and then go to Q and follow-up question afterwards.
DealPath came to us from our team saying this can make us better at our day jobs. With DealPath, it gives us the opportunity to take in all kinds of data related to our acquisitions and then utilize it in a very efficient and seamless manner across our entire real estate business.
Blackstone feels strongly about leveraging the data across our business and utilizing the best in class technology tools to further propel our business forward, and DealPath is that solution.
What DealPath does is allow us to quickly and efficiently automate our data streams. It allows us to make quick decisions, which is really the key to investing at the scale that we do.
We spent a lot of time looking for the proper solution, both looking at generic solutions, deal platforms, and DealPath was the clear winner. DealPath plays a crucial role at both the beginning and the end of the funnel. What I mean by that is when we initially approach an investment, it allows us to systematize that data, and then it also allows us to carry that data all the way through to our disposition process.
Great. So going on with this theme of, getting from where folks are just using out-of-the-box analytics that they might have today that are provided by different ERP systems or siloed systems, and kind of getting it into a place where they can use analytics in an elevated way in a step beyond what they're using it today. So for all those commercial real estate firms that might have really a treasure trove of data at their disposal, but not always stored in a ready applicable manner. For example, you might have something from your accounting system where if you had that data paired with something from your work order system or something from your acquisition pipeline, it would be very powerful. So what are some steps that you think are the most impactful to remove some of the inefficiencies and start standardizing data so everyone in the company has access to the data they need to make decisions and has the same view of the organization?
Yeah, so it's something we see a lot. So, you know, going back to the basics as well, with any strategy, I think it's important to think through what you're solving for and where your technology infrastructure is at that point. When we work with firms, we often see companies racing to build data warehouses and data lakes without really often taking the time to think through their end goals and what they're trying to get. So in situations like this, you know, they are gathering and building quite a bit of data, but oftentimes they don't really know what pieces of data is valuable. There could actually be a lot of noise, which ultimately might not be a valuable thing for them as well. So as you're thinking through it, it kind of goes back ultimately to ensuring that you are solving for each of your team's workflow first. So leveraging, you know, the right solution for that. As the adoption increases, you're getting the right valuable data in the solutions, and then using that to kind of put together a data strategy around how to warehouse and how to aggregate that together. As Kevin mentioned earlier as well, it's important to solve for needs first and kind of go from that as well. So with that, you know, we do see that being able to integrate well and slot in and out of solutions using that is a key part of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, really great points on looking how the different groups work differently and looking at their workflow for that specific group and what they need instead of just really doing a broad application across the whole firm. So really great points there, Gary. Thank you so much for being here today and sharing with us. I'm going to switch to our next speaker, LD Samuelson. He has extensive experience founding, advising, and investing and leading private technology companies. He's CEO and founder of Cherry, the leader in real estate data and insight. LD, great to have you on today.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks for having me. Awesome. So thank you everyone for joining in. Hope you had a fun time so far. For those who don't know Cherry, we're the largest real estate data warehouse in the world. We serve some of the largest banks, insurance companies, investors, both REITs and private equities, hedge funds in the world. Literally many trillions of assets under management, all powered by Cherry's data warehouse. Back to something that Aaron mentioned in the middle, our challenge today is not lack of data. Our challenge is endless data. Really, our job is to be able to make that data actionable. And I would say traditionally, the approach was, let's take all that data and put it into maybe kind of a BI layer or some type of other presentation layer. And the challenges that Aaron mentioned earlier are all the ones that are very important today that it really just doesn't work. It's just not designed for that. You really can't take that data out of that visualization layer into an API, which is how you'd want other systems to work with you, or into a machine learning stack. It's really hard to build rules into that type of environment. It really doesn't work, which is the reason that pretty much every single major owner, operator, bank, or insurance company has moved to a data warehouse or a data lake environment. What I want to do today is talk to you a little about how you might think about doing that, and hopefully how you might be able to implement something in a fast manner, right? Not something that takes, you know, many years to develop. So thinking about this process, and I know there might be a delay here on our end. I don't know where the slides are moving forward there, but when we think about this process, we typically think about it as kind of a horizontal process. First of all, we have data. Data goes from somewhere or out of somewhere, typically into a data warehouse. After the data sits within a data warehouse, we then want that data to sit in a way that's actually connected to each other. And finally, we want to get that data out of that data warehouse into something that's actionable. Let's think about those processes, right? So where does data come from? Data come from a lot of places, right? It can come from some of your ERP systems. So anything like Yardi, MRI, RealPage, and come in from modeling systems. So Argus or Anaplan, lease management systems, VTS, places like that, deal management systems like DealPath, a random Excel file from someone on the team, right? There's a really long list of those types of internal applications. It also comes from a lot of external data vendors, right? So TREP, RCA, Comstack, Reese, Moody's, a really long list of data vendors that you likely work with, right? And we have to get data out of all of those different places in a consistent, reliable manner into that data warehouse that we just said is very important, right? And that's not an easy task, right? Because those data vendors and those application vendors have very unique data structures. They change over time, right? The fact that the data schema from that data vendor was to one thing today doesn't mean that it's going to be the next exactly the same. You might drop things along the way, right? So getting data out of certain places into certain places with some stuff along the way, right? So normalizing that data, cleaning that data in a consistent, reliable manner is actually a really hard thing to do. And it's a really expensive thing to do. We talk about a lot of engineers. And we have to babysit those connections pretty regularly, right? This isn't this thing where, you know, you pay some firm, they build it once, and it just works forever. That's just not how this world works, unless you maybe just have a one-time data dump and maybe you can get away with it. But assuming that's not a one-time data dump and you want to actually have a consistent data delivery of all those different data sources into a central repository, which is really what we're talking about today, that's a lot of work. So it's a lot of money to be able to build those systems and a lot of money, obviously, to maintain those systems. Now we have our data in a place, right? Presumably a data warehouse, which is a fun name. You might hear things like data lake. You might hear words like lakehouse. You're thinking in your mind things like maybe Microsoft Azure, maybe Snowflake, if you're kind of in the buzzword day. It doesn't really matter. The point is there are two different types of data stores here, and you should be aware of what that means, right? There are transactional data stores, typically, and more analytics-focused data stores. And when we think about transactional data stores, think about, you know, an Excel spreadsheet with rows and columns. So if I want to go find a row and then find all the data, all the columns associated with that row, that's a transactional type database, right? That's really good for certain types of things. Unfortunately, it's not good for analytics type queries, which is, you know, go over our entire database and then calculate maybe the average of a certain column or maybe a certain average of a few different columns together in some type of calculation. Unfortunately, that only works with very, very small data sets. As the data sets expand and we're all dealing with big data these days, that just doesn't work, right? So when you think about building that data warehouse, don't think about an old SQL server. Think about an analytics warehouse, right? So you can build on Snowflake, you can build on, you know, Redshift or something like that. You can build on Cherry, obviously, but it has to be something that's designed for analytics. It can't be one of those old school databases. It's just not going to work. It's going to break down very quickly. It's not going to serve your needs today. Definitely not going to serve your needs in the future. And finally, within this environment, I have to get that data connected, right? So the fact that I took this data out of someplace and put it into another place in a consistent and reliable manner in a place that can be supportive of those types of queries really doesn't mean I can use that data, right? Because all those data sets are sitting siloed within that data store. That's kind of useless, right? So we have to connect those data sets. The challenge here is those data sets don't speak to each other in any meaningful manner, right? You might say, well, everything has an address. Well, let's just put it into Google and we'll have those addresses talk to each other. And anybody who's tried that before can tell you that's destined to fail, right? And there are other types of systems like that. Maybe you might use Bing or some other, you know, what they typically call geocoders off the shelf to basically take an address and convert it to a pin on the map, some kind of XY coordinate. Unfortunately, real estate doesn't work that way, right? Buildings can overlap, lots can be split. Many things don't have an XY coordinate, who the owner of the building is, a chart of accounts for maybe an accounting system. Those things just don't speak to each other anyway. And best case scenario, you might get the 70%. And in our world, 70% is basically junk, right? You know, it's garbage in, garbage out. Unless you have a really good, robust solution to be able to connect these data sets, they're basically useless, right? So now what do? Right? So we have our data coming out of some places, public data, private data, internal, external, page free, right? All those different data sources are coming reliably and consistently into a data store that's designed for analytics use case, right? It's sitting in that use case, it's sitting in that data warehouse, it's being managed data warehouse in a consistent, reliable manner, and it's being connected to that data warehouse, right? So by address, by parcel, by building, by space, by owner, by tenant, everything within your world from, you know, from accounting systems to every little esoteric piece of data within the building, you know, some of those BMS data points, you know, like sensors within the building, things like that. Everything is connected seamlessly in a way that I can now access that data. The next thing I want to do is be able to, you know, make that data actionable, right? So data is like salt, as someone said pretty recently, right? In itself, it's kind of useless, right? You can sprinkle it in some places, you can add it to a recipe, you know, it's a really good thing, but it's kind of useless on its own, right? It needs to be actionable. And that's what we're going to talk about now, right? So where does data go now that's in the data warehouse? So one place that you want it to go is obviously into a BI platform, some type of visualization layer, right? It could be in Tableau, it can be Power BI, Click. I can't remember the one that Aaron mentioned earlier, but pick your poison. It really doesn't matter. They all have pros and cons. We actually use Looker within Cherry. It's a standard that most of our clients use. It's really not a hard task to do, right? The question here is not how to build those dashboards and charts, because if you did everything up until this point, the visualization is actually the easiest part. Hardest part is actually asking, what do I want to see? And that's not necessarily trivial, right? And you might have a really good, you know, understanding of, you know, I want to see a dashboard that has the, you know, budget versus performance, or what do I own and where do I own it, or variance analysis, you know, more deep variance analysis. I want to dive in from my top of my portfolio down to an asset. Maybe I want to identify markets or new opportunities. All those different things, if you know exactly what you want to see, building dashboards is actually really easy. And just to give you an order of magnitude, you can literally pay an offshore resource $20,000 a year full-time to build dashboards day in and day out. So long as you know what you want to see in those dashboards, which again, is the hard part. That's obviously one that you want to be thinking about, which is BI, which is how your business users are typically going to interact with the data that you now have in your data store. The second use case you typically want to have is data going into an API, right? And this is how other applications are going to interact with your environment, right? So let's say you have accounting data coming out of, you know, I don't know, MRI or RealPage or one of those. And now you want to have also lease data coming out of, you know, BTS. And you want to push that data into Argus, right? You want to have a run a calc, you know, maybe a reforecasting you do every quarter. You know, I want to pull that data back into, let's say, VTS or something like that. Or maybe another example, you have a deal running in DealPath, right? Now you want to be able to go take the data into DealPath, push into an accounting system after the deal came through. Or maybe you want to pull data out of that and push it into DealPath from maybe you have access to Reese or RCA and you want to push that into a specific deal for DealPath. All of those things have to happen through an API. And again, you can't pull an API out of a BI layer. It just doesn't work that way. It's not designed for it. You can't pull it out of the data directly. This has to come out of the data store as well. At Cherry, we use GraphQL APIs, which means a single graph-based endpoint for all of your data, but you can use REST-based APIs or other ways to access data, so long as you have a strategy to get data out of that data warehouse in an API. And finally, you want that data into a machine learning stack, right? So hopefully you have a data science team right now. If you don't have a data science team right now, you should be hiring one or thinking very actively how you're building one. Go back to the 80s and 90s. The firms that won back then, the ones who built those massive data science operations, they didn't call it data science back then, but those who built those data-driven applications, those are the winners today, right? You don't want to be a loser. You right now are leading the market. You have a lot of money. You have a lot of capability. This is a time to invest in those capabilities to make sure the next 10, 20 years, you're still the winners and you don't fall behind, right? So you want to have data coming out of that analytics data store. And we just mentioned it has to be an analytics data store because otherwise your data science team really can't do anything with it, right? So now that all your data is connected, now that all data is in analytics warehouse, now it's really easy for the machine learning teams to start taking data out of it and start doing really cool things. You might want to build a knowledge graph like we do at Cherry. You might want to build classifiers and rules, as you heard a little earlier about, you know, how you might want to identify risk with tenants, right? So we partner, for example, with Equifax, which does tenant risk score. Okapi could possibly do that in a certain type of environment within your data. So things like that have to run off of a master data store, and that's why you really can't skip that stage as well. So awesome, where are we now? We've taken our data in a repeatable and consistent manner into a data warehouse. We've fused that data together with domain-specific information. Again, you want to have a data model that's very flexible, hopefully a data model that's seen every single type of data set, every single type of application, and can be malleable to be able to serve those needs. Your warehouse is purpose-built for real estate and for analytics. And finally, all that insight is automated, right? Every single dashboard chart, you know, you update something in, you know, your IR to your MRI system, and it's automated at the end of the chart. Everything is completely automated, no humans. Now we're basically mission accomplished, right? We should be celebrating. I'm just going to wrap up here. I always like to say at top of the mountain, we're all snow leopards. Anybody who can do one thing better than anyone else in the world is a natural friend of mine. We only do real estate data at Cherry, but we're the best in the world. Thank you. And you're on mute, Hazel.
Yes. Thanks, LD. Really great coverage on how to approach, you know, a lot of the different data sources and blend them all together. A lot of really great points on historical things too that I love looking at. So, I mean, a lot of folks are kind of pushing things into Tableau or Power BI and like, oh, I just want to see the things and I don't want to deal with all this stuff on the back end. And I know I have this data. I just want to see my accounting data or ERP data. So, I mean, for those folks who are like, I have analytics and it's all around and I just want it to be pushed into a visualization tool, they'll be asking the question, like, do I really need to connect my data or if I'm just going to pay someone to make a dashboard for me, right? Can you just skip a step and pay for a visualization tool without doing all the work that you mentioned?
Fortunately, the answer is no. I mean, unless you're a really small firm, you know, you don't own a lot of resources and, you know, you really just want something very simplistic and you don't really think you're going to be around 20 years from now with anything robust and maybe you can get away with it. The reality is all those connections are being built within the dashboards as well, right? So if I have data coming out of an ERP system about accounts and I have data coming out of, you know, a deal system talking about the deals, and I want to be able to visualize that data together in the same dashboard, I'm going to have to build those connections manually within that Power BI dashboard, for example. So you can't skip that stage. All you're doing is pushing it out to the visualization layer. That's not a sustainable solution. A, they're not designed to do that. There are a lot of limitations about on what type of connections you can do at the visualization layer. Those limitations don't exist at data store level. It's not a repeatable process. You can't have live updates into those BI platforms. You can't take it out into an API. You can't take it out into a machine learning stack. So it's just not possible to do that. You have to build the modern data store you have, or data lake, or whatever type of architecture you're working on, where all the connections happen there, right? And if you skip that stage for whatever reason, you're basically going to get junk in your analytics layer. And if for whatever reason you did all of that massive work to connect data really, really well in the analytics layer, and I would challenge any firm to show me that they're able to do that. But let's say you were somehow able to do that. You invested millions of dollars in man hours to do that. Well, now what? Every single time you want to do any type of little change, all that has to happen within that BI tool, and nothing's repeatable, right? So, and if you want to change that BI platform for whatever reason, as Aaron mentioned earlier, that's it. You're kind of screwed, right? Because you built all these, you know, manual connections within that, and it will never be able to be replicated. So there's a lot of challenges why that doesn't work. But I would say the most important one isn't the one for right this second. All those ones I just mentioned are for now. The most important one is all of your future data science just can't work on that, right? So BI is really good for descriptive and declarative analytics, right? What happened, and to a certain degree, why it happened, basic correlation analysis. But anything beyond that, it's going to go into a very, you know, it's going to go into JupyterBook or something like that. It's going to go into a graph. It's going to go into some kind of machine learning environment. And those things just don't know how to work out of BI platforms. They never will. They're just not designed for that. Those need to run on the data store, and specifically an analytics data store. So you can't skip that stage, unfortunately. The good news is there are good solutions out there that you can adopt pretty quickly without having to go spend millions of dollars and years worth of work. And that's why most of the large companies use Jira.
Great. Really great points on making a forward-facing platform internally for any company. So thanks you so much for sharing. LD, really great to have you on today. And I'll move to our last presenter, Brooks Alwart. He is an enterprise service manager with Drone Deploy. He has an engineering background and extensive operations experience, and specializes in helping organizations create effective drone operations systems. So Brooks, I'll have you take it away from here.
Okay, thank you, Hazel. Thanks for playing that video really quickly. Thanks everyone for having me. I'm Brooks. I work at Drone Deploy, and hopefully that video probably does a better job of explaining what Drone Deploy actually is, but I'm gonna verbalize it here really quickly. So in essence, Drone Deploy is a cloud-based software that automates the capture of information and images and videos with the drone, and then processes those images into useful information for customers. So how does that relate to real estate and big data and all of the stuff that we're talking about today? I'm going to take you guys through a customer journey of one of our big box retailers. Unfortunately, I'm not allowed to say their name, but of how we're using drone data to help them. And if I can reference a slide Hazel mentioned earlier, or shared earlier, of the market, we fit right into that construction and project or facilities maintenance category. So that's what really the focus of the drone data that we'll be sharing today is going to be all about. So the hot word in the industry right now is digital twin, and this is literally sort of essentially what Drone Deploy does. We're creating digital replicas of physical assets for our customers. So this is kind of like our one slide fits all of what our facilities management customers are using Drone Deploy for. So when the drone actually flies over your property, it takes hundreds, sometimes thousands of images. Drone Deploy then takes those images of the property and stitches them together into 2D and 3D representations of that actual asset. So in this case, this is what's called an orthomosaic, or the 2D representation. We then take those products and then iterate out actual information for our customers. So in this case, we have issues marked up, we have panoramas captured to visually represent our customer site. And we have a whole bunch of things that this particular customer is looking for to help them manage their maintenance budget. So to take it a step back, our customer came to us and says, we need help managing our maintenance budgets each year, and it's really hard to do that. So we in turn worked with them to figure out, okay, what are the things that are actually important to you? And we started with sort of three different aspects of how they are evaluating their maintenance budget. And one of them is for this big box retailer's pavement. Another is roofs, and then sort of the holistic like exterior management of all things that go along with their actual property. And then sort of a cue for the end is there's also some interior work as well that we're doing. So let's kind of break these things down here that we have. So starting with sort of roofs and exterior as a whole, I think the slide or the image on the left rather does a good job of highlighting what we're actually providing for customers. You can see we have a bunch of green pins that are items that our customer has said we really care about figuring out where these things are located on a roof. Green means it's not in a bad condition, so there's no need for repair. Yellow pins suggest we need to take a look at this thing that's on a roof. This could suggest some sort of damage or water ponding, et cetera. And red is like, we really need to check that out. So then from this data that's captured by drone and processed in drone deploy, we then create automated reports that we send to this customer, and they're able to get a more holistic view of their actual project based on this capture, and it's essentially real time. In addition to just RGB data that's captured from a drone, we also use thermal sensors, and DroneDeploy is great at processing thermal data that's captured. This naturally ties into roofs. Probably as many of you guys know, we're looking for thermal anomalies or heat signatures that typically are suggesting things like water ponding, membrane leaks, anything like that. And the other like real sort of maybe not totally quantified thing that we're addressing here is we're helping people that are actually sending boots on the roof know exactly where to go when you actually do need to send someone up for that maintenance. So they, instead of having to evaluate the entire roof, and some of these roofs are really big in terms of square footage, we already have areas that we want to check out or areas that we know we need to fix ahead of time. Additionally, sometimes the properties that our customers own aren't necessarily, you know, 30-foot tall standard rectangles or regular polygons, but sometimes they're vertically challenged properties. So in this case, our customer is typically spending sometimes days or even entire days to set up a swing stage to visually inspect the facade of their building for window replacement, looking for cracks, leaks, like any sort of damage, et cetera. In our case, we were able to use a drone, fly this facade in a automated flight path, which you can kind of see on the left, super cool. And this took about 15 minutes to actually capture, a few hours to process the data, and then everything was in the customer's hands. So they could perform that exact same inspection by using a swing stage with images and data that's processed from a drone. So again, saving employees time, saving money, these are the things that, you know, our customers are interested in with drone data. So the actual physical access, which is fun. Finally, pavement. So a lot of the big box retailers have major amounts of pavement that are part of their property. And so using drone data, we can automate the inspection of the pavement that they have, looking at different cracks, alligatoring, curbs that need to be replaced, like all of these things. And we have AI tools that will go in and actually identify these issues on the pavement. And then we have a team of engineers that then go and further identify the scope of repair for the individual customers. And so we try to tailor it based on their actual needs. The final product that we end up giving them is what's called a PCI score along with the report. And this helps them prioritize maybe that individual project of, okay, here are the areas of the pavement that are most in need. And it's, you know, we try to keep everything consistent with a standard sort of red, yellow, green. Green is good, yellow is maybe or probably needs repair soon, and red is really bad. PCI in the pavement industry just means pavement condition index, and that's sort of a standard way of rating and scoring your pavement. And then finally, I'll be brief here, but the next area we're looking at is if we have physical assets, we've covered everything on the exterior, but Drone Deploy can now process data on the interior of our customer stores as well. So we can get live looks and identify issues if things are located in the wrong spot, take measurements, and then create reports from the interiors of our buildings. And even though it's not maybe the sexiest slide that we have here, this is one is probably my favorite, because if you look at all of the sort of like features and reports that I kind of just discussed, they're maybe like really valuable for an individual project. However, a lot of the retailers and customers we're working with have multiple properties. And so they need to figure out, they have annual maintenance budgets, and they need to figure out where do they need to spend, because they can't spend it on every single property that they own. What are the hot spots that they need to target this year with their budget so that that budget gets the most effective use for that entire year? So we help then take the scope that we get from our customers and then rank each individual property that is flown and process and Drone Deploy. And I believe that is my last slide.
Great. Thank you so much, Brooks, for sharing your really different point of view from the rest of the panel. I really love the drone information and the new sets of data that's bringing in. So dealing with a lot of clients that are, you know, like you said, dealing with the most favorite time of year, the annual budget, right? For specifically annual yep. budgeting and, you know, deferred maintenance. And I'm thinking from an acquisitions point of view, you know, knowing what I'm getting into when I'm looking at a property. How have you seen clients change the way they've been doing their maintenance budgeting for the last year compared to before the pandemic?
Yeah, well, especially with the pandemic, the one really sort of nice thing about drones is they are COVID friendly. So drone, it's much easier instead of sending a team of people or shipping someone out and flying people to different properties, which is often what happens. It's usually like a small team of people that are doing the evaluations. Drones and even sometimes drone services contractors that already live in the area are taking the place of having people travel and visit each site, so then they can then capture projects faster. The other thing that is really useful in that sense is we're creating oftentimes a more standard deliverable if sometimes customers are working with different contractors to actually get this information, and usually it's more efficient. Like we said, flying a drone over an entire property can, if say you have a 100-acre property, which is really huge, you could fly a drone over that in a matter of 10, 20 minutes. So versus a person actually walking the entire site. So I'd say kind of to summarize, faster, more standardized, and COVID friendly.
Got it. Great, thank you so much for sharing that, Brooks. I'd like to invite all of the other panelists up on stage for the Q&A session. And then we'll start with a question for Brooks, LD, and Gary first, once we have everyone on stage. So question to our tech partners here. What are the newer decisions that your clients have been needing to make in the last year compared to before? And what kind of insights for them have been critical in this process and why? So Brooks and LD and Gary, if you're still on, feel free to take that question. And I have a separate question for Kevin, Arian, and Pete.
Sure, I can take that off. One of the things that I think changed a lot in the beginning of COVID, we started getting questions around risk that maybe wasn't taken into consideration earlier on. And I think that prior to COVID, I think a lot of things that were obviously risk factors were just never really considered, right? So all of a sudden we got questions like, you know, what's my exposure to Gen Z in my multifamily buildings? We think they're going to move back in with their parents and, you know, they're going to vacate these buildings. And all of a sudden, you know, they start asking things like, you know, well, post-COVID, you know, are lawyers going to go back to their offices in droves? You know, maybe they're not going to be that many. What's my exposure to the legal industry in the markets I'm in? Not just, you know, my specific properties, but in the markets as well. And there are a lot of other examples like that. And I think the insurance world, we see different things. You know, typically we see things around flood or fire risk. Today we also see things around demographic risk, right? So crime really was never part of an underwriting model for pretty much any of the insurance companies that I'm aware of prior to the pandemic. And all of a sudden, crime's a real thing, right? There are certain places where properties that up until now really weren't at risk also are getting burned down, right? Or vandalized in ways that are actually become insurance claims, right? So I think a lot of things around risk that probably should have been front and center before COVID have become front and center now. So I think all those things are part of it. And I think more than anything, it was just a catalyst for many firms to say, wait a minute, we don't know anything about our own properties. We don't know anything about the data. We have all these different data sources, you know, that we have as an organization, internal, external, but we really don't know how to make sense of any of those. And let's figure out how do we actually do that. I think it's probably the biggest catalyst.
Yeah, really great, really great perspective on risk, LD. Gary Brooks?
Yeah, I was going to add on to something we saw last year was also, to some extent, it really forced a lot of firms to think about, you know, accelerating their technology strategy and adoption in times of people working remote, not having access to the office. So, you know, to some extent, it's a good forcing function to think through what are commercially available as technologies for you to work as a team. Also, a good time to look at, you know, what is out there that your peers and folks in the industry are using. So from our side, we saw an uptick in use and collaboration software, which, you know, for us leveraging workflow tools, it's been a kind of good way to kind of seg into that as well.
Great.
Yep. I don't know if I'd call it like a new question, but just given the pandemic, I think maintenance budgets weren't always like top of priority list for some of these retailers that we're working with. So the question that they're always asking and then can maybe asking even more during the pandemic is like, how can we be more efficient? How can we be leaner as a company? How can we use the same or less resources to still get the same information or get the same output out of what we're doing? And so I guess sort of fortunately, we're kind of a natural fit in that case.
Great. Thank you, Brooks. So for these questions for Kevin, Aaron, and Pete. So, all right, so the year is 2020. It is the end of February. We're looking on the precipice of March. So if you're standing in your pre-pandemic shoes at that point, what would be the top data project that you would have prioritized knowing what you know now and why?
I'll jump into
go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, this is a softball question to us, right? It's like IoT, IAQ, and let's take like wellness out of the picture. I would just say like if we had adopted an IoT program, then we would have been able to, you know, drop in those IAQ initiatives underneath that. Because there were so many learnings that we had to do simultaneously, not only like learn the air quality world, but also like learn how to securely set up IoT. So we had to make a lot of changes to our network. We had to do like wiring and building networking, figuring out gateways and, you know, internal communication that way, along with understanding like, you know, ozone, temperature, humidity, and those types of values that were important.
You know, for us, I don't know if it would have been much of a really a change. You know, we had a major focus on at that time on our JV data collection, you know, from partners, reaching out to a third party, helping us leverage that, convert it from, you know, whatever their reporting format is into our Yardi system. And I think it just accelerated that more. I didn't know that I would say that, hey, there was a change, but again, it's kind of what I mentioned earlier. It was, yeah, this program sounds great. It should be helpful to, you know, said, oh my gosh, how do we hurry up and get this across the line? And I was like, well, you know, people and money. So
I think, across probably all 40 of our enterprise clients, like, I think all of them gave us the same answer is that if we had known that virtual collaboration communication was actually going to get adopted by force and not by desire, they would have enabled the sharing of information while keeping in mind how to only give the right people the right set of information, right? When you think about data governance and access and sharing of relevant information, that would have been ready in March so that different corporate departments could communicate with one another when they were used to going into an office to do so. Different geographic regions could communicate. Allocators could communicate with each of their JV partners and property managers without having to go meet them. Everybody got Zoom fatigue really fast. It seemed really cool for a couple months, and then it was just, oh, so now that I'm home, you think I'm available from 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. and not normal hours, and Zoom, 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 Zoom. So if I could just have all the information in front of me so that I could avoid some of these meetings and solve with an email or a dashboard what could have, what likely took a meeting, that would be fantastic.
Great. So from what I'm hearing, having IoT set up for the buildings so you know how to manage that, also accelerating your data analytics projects to a point of maturity, and then lastly, having the information you need to avoid the Zoom fatigue. And there's a lot of psychological studies been done on Zoom on why it is fatiguing. So great points, everyone. And yeah, really great discussion here today. I'm going to hand it off to Sarah to close.
All right, thank you so much. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I think we could have gone on for another hour with a great discussion with the panelists. I really appreciate you sharing your insights with the community. And of course, thanks to the attendees for joining us today. And a special thanks to Hazel for moderating today's session. I really appreciate it. I want to invite you to join us for our next webinar, which will be next week on digital twins. I think Brooks actually brought it up, the topic, so I think it will be a great follow-up to this week's session, and hope you will be able to join us. And with that, I wish everyone a wonderful rest of your day.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Have a good one.